We Have Issues is a weekly podcast full of reviews of comics and oversharing. We use grown-up language to make very childish jokes. You can find the show at wehaveissues.net, as well as anywhere else where average to not too bad podcasts can be found.
Start some really boring conversation with a colleague, then please do. If not, do not go through that for me.
There isn't a way of asking any question that doesn't end up in a boring conversation with a colleague. That's the nature of work. And some exciting conversations with colleagues. We had a conversation. We've had my boss is away this week, so we've had lots of nice conversations about just fun stuff, none of which I can now remember. I've done such a good job of presenting a certain version of myself in the office and on the internet that now people just assume I'm a really grumpy, quite stupid person. And so I'll say things like last week on Twitter, I said something about not understanding whether Tony Hart was dead or not.
Is he dead or not?
He died in 2009, apparently.
Oh, okay.
And then a few people, and then somebody this week obviously shared the news story. Just came across the news story about him being dead in 2009, shared it as if it was new information, and then the whole of Twitter was freaked out and sad that Tony Hart had just died. And then Facebook was a little bit as well. And then it got reported by the main press that people on Twitter are stupid because they didn't realise that Tony Hart died in 2009. And so I just tweeted something about not knowing whether Tony Hart was dead or not now. And loads of people explained to me that they thought he died years ago. And I was like, no, it's a joke because everyone's going on about it.
I think maybe it just didn't translate.
Like most of my jokes.
You need to have audio on your... So you need to say it. Record yourself saying it.
I think I'm quite deadpan sometimes. I don't think people always really... Because in the office, people think I'm stupid as well.
Yeah, but they're colleagues. They're not people you've chosen to follow.
No, that's true. I made a really good joke about Bader-Meinhof syndrome or whatever it was on Twitter the other day, James sent me a private message saying, "Did you just make a really cool joke about Bader-Meinhof?" And I said, "Yeah," but nobody else noticed it, and I can't remember what it was now, but it was really good.
Well, if James, as one of your good friends, had to privately message you to confirm the joke, it may be that others were worried and didn't feel like they could private message you to check the joke.
Yeah. Everyone, all of my jokes are so subtle and complicated that people need to check. Yeah, I think you're right. They're really good jokes, and that's why people need to check, because it's never clear, because I'm a comedy genius.
Yeah, you should be a bit more Michael McIntyre. Maybe that will people like that, don't they? They like Mr. McIntyre.
Yeah, so, he's very popular.
Yeah, so, just do a bit of that. That'll be fine. I know, start with that, and then ease in your own work, and they'll appreciate it in time.
So start with Michael McIntyre, and then ease myself in. Yeah. That's what I'm getting from that.
Yeah.
Okay, James isn't actually here.
Nope.
He has reviewed some comics, which we will share with you, listener. I'm here, it's Nick, and Jane's here.
Hello, I'm Jane.
It's not been that long since you were last here.
2 weeks, I think.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
But it always seems like such a long time, because I missed you.
Oh!
It does seem like I haven't seen... Because I see James an awful lot.
You do.
So sometimes there isn't even a microphone there. So then when I don't see you for even just a week, it gets very confusing.
I think I'm a little more easygoing than James as well, too.
A little bit more easygoing. Oh, bless him. I mean, yeah. But, I mean, he can't, like, he's got a diagnosis and everything.
Yeah, I know. He's working on it.
Yeah. I haven't got a diagnosis, so I don't have to work on anything, I've discovered. that's how it works.
Yeah, that is how it works.
So it's just me and Jane. Not just. I mean, we're plenty. I'm going to talk about some new comics. Jane has a spotlight book, which she's going to talk about. She's got Black Hole by Charles Burns.
That's right, yeah.
Which is a gigantic book.
It is. And it's actually inspired by you.
By me?
Not the story. Oh, no, not the story. Oh. But because when we used to record on the Inner Avenue part of Southampton, and this was on your shelf.
Oh.
And I really liked the cover, and I was like, oh, I want to know what that book is. So eventually got it.
It's pretty gorgeous.
Yes.
It's very striking as well. We won't talk about it. But someone in The Guardian, and it was, I mean, to be fair, it was entirely a clickbait article. Because The Guardian ran two articles about comics this week. As Mark Ellerby has pointed out, I didn't realise this, but Mark Ellerby, the comic drawer, pointed out that The Guardian does a horribly trolley article about comics at least once a year just to try and get people fired up and paying attention to them. So they had one really good article written by someone that was reviewing a few recent comics.
Okay.
And then they had another one by an art critic, by one of their art writers, that was just a load of bollocks about how the art is uninspired and boring. He seems to have read maybe two comics and gone into W.H. Smith's and looked at what they had and just been stupid. And one of the examples he cited Scott McCloud's comics, who did Understanding Comics. He talked about Charles Burns. I don't know if it was Black Hole, but he talked about Charles Burns and Chris Ware's Acme Novelty Library, all of which are really different and really fine arty
in their
style.
Yeah, they're not... I don't want to say run of the mill, but they aren't, as someone new into comics or someone exploring comics or even just thinking about getting into comics, they're not what you'd first give to people. They'd build up to those sorts of things.
Yeah. And he basically said that they were, do you know, the more I think about it, the more it was specifically designed to get a particular sort of person wound up, because he wasn't talking about superhero comics. He specifically targeted the ones that people talk about being actually great and really inventive and visually inventive and stuff, and he savaged those. And then I and it's cool. I understand why this wound people up, and I was glad that people paid attention anyway. But I did tweet and Facebook about how I tweeted a link to it, which was my mistake. But I also said, because he says in the first sentence, I read some Alan Moore comics I liked in the late 90s and I haven't, in the early 90s, and I haven't really read any comics since. So I said something about how, you know, when someone says in their first paragraph that they don't really care about a medium, you don't have to care about their opinion about a medium. And I said that, but of course the content was so obnoxious that that's what people picked up on, and it got, still got a lot of shares and retweets and stuff, so that was nice. I like that. It's become quite important to me as time has gone on how popular I am online.
I've just gone the opposite. I've just, like, a ghost, not online at all.
Never. Yeah. But if you do want to talk to either of us on Twitter, listener, I'm Nick Sight. Jane is a ghost.
I'm Cover Jane, at Cover Jane.
On Twitter. And I'm on Facebook, and the podcast is on Facebook at We Have Issues, and it's on Twitter at IssuesPod, and you can email us at issuespod@gmail.com, and you can listen to all the past episodes of the podcast at wehaveissues.net. There's full show notes on every episode, and also in your podcatcher of choice. I use Pocket Casts. Apple apparently have a really good podcatching thing now. If you do listen to us on any of those things, please do share us. We want people to listen.
We like being shared.
Yeah, I mean, it's more important to me that people like the jokes I make on Twitter. I think if people did like the jokes I made on Twitter, I'd start to suspect them of not being very clever. But because none of them do like my jokes on Twitter, there's a thing Dan Harmon says where... There's this thing that certain sorts of comedians and famous people do and are, where there's a need in them to be recognised, to have people like them. But then, because they hate themselves so much, once people do like them, they kind of resent the people who like them, because they're like, but you like me, why? I'm a fucking monster.
That is weird.
I know. I think I might have it, though.
That's not being contrary, though.
I don't think it's contrary.
Maybe it's some sort of syndrome.
People are complicated, I think, is what it's about.
Complicated
it's probably some sort of narcissistic disorder.
reverse narcissism.
Yeah. But in terms of sharing the podcast, that isn't narcissistic. That's we just, you know, if you like what we do, we clearly like what we do, which is why we do it. So if you think people like it, share it, because that's what nice people do. Oh, Jane, what you didn't know is last week we did a draw. I found some comics that were some recent comics that were quite good and were very cheap at the comic shop. There were two issues of Alex DeCampi's Grindhouse comic. It was a two-part story with art by R.M. Guerra. It's like a supernatural horror story thing.
Okay.
And the first Dark Horse did a series of cheap first issues of things. They did a Usagi Yojimbo grass cutter one. And so I had all of those. And we actually did a draw so that someone can win those three comics.
Yeah.
It's just a tiny little thing. Just a little thing. Not a big deal. But basically, they just had to share either retweet or link to last week's episode or share it on Facebook or write a post about it. And basically, if they retweeted or shared something, because it doesn't take a lot of effort, they got one ticket, one like raffle ticket.
Okay.
If they tweeted or posted on Facebook specifically about it, just on their own, they got two raffle tickets. And if they did a blog post, an actual proper blog post about us, linking to it, they got five tickets.
Wow.
And then
that's a good system. I like that system.
It's quite good. Someone did tell me on Facebook that it might be a bit complicated, but I like it.
It's not complicated.
I think it's quite simple, isn't
it?
Yeah. That person was wrong. I don't think they listened, so it's okay to say that. And so a few people took part. Rather awkwardly, for a couple of days, it looked like the only person who was going to retweet any of the links was Alex DeCampi, who is the person who's done one of the comics. So I was
You'd
a little bit worried about that.
Something else to send him.
Yeah.
You'd have to send him like a whisper or something.
Yeah. Or it's would a whisper go in there? I think.
And a pair of pants.
I think that might constitute sexual harassment.
What? No, you're not saying. You know, that's not. Why is that a sexual? I don't know.
Just clean pants.
Yeah, just a nice pair of clean pants. Isn't that what every man wants?
Alex DeCampi's a lady.
Oh.
Alex.
Oh, whoops.
Alex is one of those names.
It is one of those names. Okay, yeah, that would be weird. I see why that would be weird now. And isn't it odd actually sending her underwear, ladies' underwear, would be weird too?
Sending either gender, clean or dirty, either
but
thing
is kind
of. If
she was a man and you sent her women's or men's underwear, that would be okay. Isn't that strange?
I don't know if it'd be okay as such. It's just no man has ever complained about something like that because it's attention. Men thrive on that sort of thing.
And men don't like buying underwear, so maybe they just like people sending them. Okay,
I don't like wearing underwear.
We could send her instead. Definitely still whisper. I think they're genderless.
I think the only thing about a whisper is it, once you put it in a jiffy bag, it's probably a little bit too thick to go as a large letter.
Oh, okay. All right, a Malteser teaser chocolate bar.
That'll
then.
Do it.
That'll
I think definitely something like that. Or a couple of Kinder Buenos are probably smaller.
Oh, they might get crushed in transit, though.
Yeah. Which actually with a Kinder Bueno, because they've got that kind of nice bite into it thing, al dente. Kinder Bueno's a kind of al dente and you don't want
to
mess with that, so no, you're right.
They need to be intact.
But anyway, she didn't win, so that's good, because it would have been really complicated. The person who did win was, funnily enough, one of our contributors this week and the person who does our theme tune, and that's David Wynn, won.
Wow.
But to be fair, as much as that probably seems a little bit sketchy, he did like write this amazing blog post about us on Tumblr, which scored him 5 points,
wow,
baby.
Wow, okay.
So
that's not nepotism, is it, at all?
No.
No, okay, that's good.
Not this time, probably next time. So I'm going to send his comics out to him fairly soon.
We could send him some clean pants.
What are you saying? Do you think he needs clean pants?
No, I'm just saying you could.
There's I found some other cheap comics this week.
Ooh, what have we got for this?
At the moment, it's quite handy because Alphabet and Planet, when they don't manage to sell through on something, they put it out cheap. So, listener, it's not that we don't appreciate you, but we're on a budget, okay? So there's
Ooh,
two.
One of them's good, though. One of them's very good.
Yeah,
I
so
can't
there's,
see the other one.
There's two. Image have been doing these first issue special deals as well. So they've got the first issue. Image First, they're called. There's the first issue of Witches, which, if you haven't read it, is a great horror comic. Really, really good. and really creepy by Scott Snyder and Jock.
Who are both men.
Yes. Yeah, Jock could be...
He's definitely a man.
Yeah.
He impregnated a lady and had a baby, so...
Did that happen?
Yeah.
Okay. Southern Bastards, number one. Southern Bastards, I guess you'd say, if you're an American or just a northerner?
Just a northerner.
Okay.
Specifically from Yorkshire, I think.
How do Americans say it? Southern Bastards.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So Americans like northerners? Yeah. Yeah?
No.
Maybe?
No.
No, okay. But Southern Bastards, which I call this the genre rural noir, which has a lot of rolling R noises that I can't quite manage. It's written by Jason Aaron with art by Jason Latour, and it's basically set in a small town, a small southern town in America. A guy who had a bad relationship with his father goes home to sell the family house and ends up getting embroiled in all of this stuff that he'd... This town is a shitty town. You realise that really, really quickly. And he ends up getting embroiled in all of that stuff. So it's got all of this good stuff that's like shows like Justified or Banshee. It's that sort of small-town crime story thing with really hard characters in. But it's really good. Both Southern Bastards and Witches are quite grown up. I think they're quite adult.
So no under 18s, we're saying.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to check, but be careful. Don't enter this draw to get comics for your 5-year-old kid, I guess. But anyway, the third comic is actually the first part of a 4-part series. We didn't cover it when it came out, but I have actually read it online, and it's lovely. It's Abigail and the Snowman by Roger Langridge. It's from Kaboom, which is Boom's imprint for kids. Roger Langridge's art and writing is just brilliant anyway. And it's the story of a little girl called Abigail who doesn't really fit in with her school friend, with you know, her peers at school. She lives with her dad. They don't have a lot of money. And there's lots of nice interplay with them between that. But then into this, an abominable snowman eventually comes. So that's in the drawer as well. That's a great comic. It's really, really nice. These are good comics.
I think that one is suitable for 5-year-olds.
Yeah, probably, I think. So same thing again. If you retweet any tweets that link to the episode, this episode specifically, you'll get one ticket for the draw. If you write a new tweet or post on Facebook that links to this episode, that's two. And if you write a blog post about this episode or linking to this episode, that's 5. And we'll do a draw again next week. We will reconvene here next episode to see who won that.
Good luck.
I'm trying to be professional about this. So James will be there'll be a contribution from James later. There's contribution from Maxi Barnard about the history of manga. It's his first proper episode of
Yay.
That. There's an event management from Peter Hammerson. That's about the Kree-Skrull War. And sadly, Brett Ewins, a British comic creator who was very heavily involved in 2000 AD and was one of the founders of the comic Deadline, which was hugely influential to certainly people my age. He died recently, and we have David Wynn talking about that.
Hello, my name's David Wynn. I'm a cartoonist. Regular listeners will know me as a regular contributor to the Momcast, the previous podcast, to We Have Issues, and as the writer of the theme tune to We Have Issues. Read Spacescape at spacescapecomic.tumblr.com. That's the introductions done. I am contributing today to talk about Brett Ewins. James asked me to record something as he knows that I am a big fan of Mr. Ewins' work. And this week we had the very, very sad news that Brett Ewins passed away. It is very difficult to overstate the importance of Brett Ewins in British comics. He started work for 2000 AD within the first year of its publication. He was a co-founder and arguably the driving force in the foundation of Deadline magazine. If you want a really good obituary, I recommend going to Down the Tubes, I think it's downthetubes.net. I'm not 100% sure. Google Down the Tubes. There's an obituary by Tim Pilcher that's very good. I want to talk a little bit about my personal connection to his work. He brought the punk aesthetic to British comics in a way that nobody else had before him and that was hugely influential. He studied at Goldsmiths College, which gives that gives a personal connection for me, as my mum actually worked at Goldsmiths for 30 years in the library and was probably working there when he was there. Goldsmiths, for those who don't know, was kind of the epicentre of in a lot of ways, it was one of the epicentres of the punk aesthetic in the late 70s, early 80s. Malcolm McLaren went to Goldsmiths. I believe Vivian Westwood went to Goldsmiths. At Goldsmiths, Brett Ewins met Peter Milligan and Brendan McCarthy. They worked together on a lot of things. I mean, if you get the Best of Milligan and McCarthy book, I have a copy of that at home. The first half of the book is kind of full of Brett Ewins artwork because the three of them would work together as a very organic group and collaborate almost seamlessly. I don't want to say McCarthy owes a lot to Ewins because that's not fair, that's not correct, but certainly they were a very big part of each other's artistic development. So the thing that Ewins brought to 2000 AD, one of the big things he brought was his use of collage and photocopies. Yes, photocopies, which sounds awful, doesn't it? But he would use a lot of photocopies in his artwork. He would draw a picture and then he would photocopy it and manipulate it, either through ways of distorting that copy or through touching it up and changing things. Many of his pages were almost as much collage as they were drawing, and he didn't hide it. It led to a very interesting look on the page. A Brett Ewins page, the best way I can describe it is saying if you look at the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen album cover and compare that to the pound note, that's a Brett Ewins page compared to a Brian Bolland page. He brought a new vibrancy to comics that up till that point, British comics at that point they looked like Battle or Commando. And suddenly, after Ewins, they looked like something completely different. In the late 80s, he and Steve Dillon got together and founded Deadline. Ewins was pretty much responsible for the addition of Jamie Hewlett to the magazine, and so therefore could be said to be responsible for Tank Girl, even in an indirect kind of way. The face of British comics without Ewins' influence on 2000 AD and without Deadline would be something very, very different. We would not have the vibrancy and the voice that we do without him. And my life would be, my comics reading life would have been much poorer without Johnny Nemo and Bad Company. I strongly recommend, if you're not familiar with his work, that you seek out Johnny Nemo, that you seek out Freak Wave, a comic that he did with Milligan and McCarthy, and that you seek out Bad Company, all three of those written by Peter Milligan. Bad Company in particular is an amazing piece of pacifist fiction. It's a war comic, but it's about how awful war is, told through an sci-fi adventure lens. I can't fully prepare you for how good it is, and I don't think I want to. I'd rather you just read it. Ewins was an unsung hero of British comics. All of his contemporaries are part of the pantheon now. You know, Steve Dillon is a superstar artist. Brendan McCarthy is a Hollywood big shot. Jamie Hewlett is a millionaire rock star. You know, Peter Milligan ain't doing too badly for himself. You know, Ewins died unsung in a London hospital. He suffered greatly in later life with serious mental illness, which prevented him from working. If you Google him, you will find a lot about that and about the trials and tribulations that he went through. It's a difficult one to talk about, that part. of his life, because it's really important that we talk about mental illness and that we recognise the stigma that it carries. And it's really heartbreaking that he suffered the way that he did. But at the same time, I personally would not want him remembered as a victim or a martyr. I would rather he be remembered as the great artist that he was and important voice that he was. Read his work. And, yeah. Thanks for listening. That's me done, I think. Bye.
Shall I talk about this week's comics?
Yes, please do.
Right. So, we'll listen to James talking about his new comics this week, and then I'll talk about mine straight afterwards.
Hello. Hello. Thank you, Nick. And Jane. James here. I'm too lazy and feckless to come into the studio this week, so I'm going to record something right here. In my at home. Hello, I'm talking to you from my home. I don't like doing this without someone else being here. I feel really self-conscious, and I've just watched an episode of Nathan Barley, so I'm feeling really self-aware and a bit ridiculous. In truth, it's very strange. Yeah, no, you're an idiot. I have got some comic books to review though, which is good, because otherwise I'd probably just have to monologue about the weather or something, or I don't know, topical events or something, and that's not really very entertaining to listen to a man on his own recording into a microphone just talking about topical events. Okay, so I thought I bought three comic books this week, and I bought them from Comixology, which is I've been talking about on the show when I've been reviewing stuff. I'm really into now. I save a lot of money compared to when I was buying floppies. I miss the interaction of going into a local comic book shop, though. That's a shame, and I do miss the guys in there. They were very nice, they're very knowledgeable. But I spend less, and I get a wider variety of books to choose from. And I think at least two of these probably wouldn't have been on our shelves this week, and I probably wouldn't have picked up to read. So it's the beauty of Comixology. I've said it plenty of times, but I think it's well worth it. If you've got a tablet, you know, an iPad or an Android thing, it's well worth downloading and well worth checking out, because loads and loads of the comics on there are very cheap as well. Not only are the big titles cheaper than maybe you'd expect to buy them in the shops, but you can buy indie stuff that you wouldn't otherwise find for a really reasonable price. And it's also because it's an environment where you don't feel like you should be getting things for free, maybe it's, I guess, a nice way for indie publishers to get stuff out there that they're actually going to get paid for, rather than having to create their own web architecture. I don't really know how you go about getting things on Comixology. Do you know, I think maybe for the next show or something, I should try and find that out, shouldn't I? Really, rather, before I start sort of pontificating on whether I think it's a good way for indie creators to get their stuff on here, because I really, otherwise, I don't really know what I'm talking about, and I could be wrong, and that would be bad. That'd be very bad, and I'd feel awful about it. So there's unintentionally a Western theme running through this, although the first book I'm going to talk about doesn't have a Western theme at all. It's a global. In fact, it's universal and beyond the theme of the first book I'm going to talk about. It's on Action Lab, the Action Lab Danger Zone imprint. And it retails at $3.99. I think I bought it for £3.49, maybe even that. Actually, I think it might have been £1 something on Comixology. I think it might have been £1.49. And it's holy fuck, or holy F*CK, which is written by Nick Marino with art by Daniel Aruda Massa. It's issue 4, I think, as I said, and I haven't read the other three. So that's kind of from the start. You might be thinking, well, that's really a stupid thing to have done. You don't really know, You don't really know what's going on in the story, so that's kind of dumb picking it up. And but the title struck me, and I read briefly what it's about. And briefly, what it's about. And well, I'll give you the summary because Nick liked this. Nick likes it when I read things verbatim from places. The summary so far is: Jesus has taken flight directly to Zeus and Isis, the two mythological gods leading a horde of desperate worship hungry deities. But do Jesus, Satan and Sister Maria actually stand a chance, and can they keep their shit together long enough to stop the coming madness? Now what's apparent very early on is that a team of Jesus, the devil and this nun are basically fighting against the old Greek gods. So it's kind of you know, two mythologies clashing against each other. It's an epic story for the ages. This one, this issue sees the Olympians fire a missile, I guess at Earth, I'm assuming it's at Earth, and Jesus has to stop it from destroying its given target. And in a prolonged action scene, he does just that in the crudest way possible. Jesus fucks the missile to disable it, whilst the Greek gods watch on the television, thereby saving humanity, which is very good. Which is the main theme of this particular story. It's highly sacrilegious, and certainly not for someone who's easily offended in that area. It's I found it very funny. It kind of does what it says it's going to do on the tin. It's a really crude, kind of schoolboyish dig at religion. It's a sideways swipe, written in a very sort of Porky's humour, if you like. But I have to say, for all that, it's not the most sophisticated book I've ever read in my life. But the art's very enjoyable. It reminded me very much of the work in Chew. Is that kind of style, and the humour too seems to take its cues from John Layman's book there. It's very frenetic, it's very snappy, lots of sort of witty one-liners and comebacks and so forth, and lots of very, very, very silly characters. And this book is possibly the silliest thing I've read in almost as long as I can remember, which I enjoyed. Given it doesn't cost an awful lot on the Comixology store, I think I'm probably going to go back and just have a look at how the story gets here. And I'll probably see it finish off. It is it's ridiculous, and if you like ridiculous sacrilegious comedy, then I recommend it. Go and check it out. It's good fun. The second book I read, and this is to start the Western theme, is a book that cost 69p. It's called The Dead Don't Die. It's by Working Class Press, and it is written and drawn by James Guy Hill. It looks like it might have been published a few years previously, but basically this sees a lone gunslinger confronted by zombies early on. But he's clearly a mission. He goes to a town and has a standoff with a couple of ne'er-do-wells from the local town, and he's showing a picture around, and he's clearly looking for some. But he finds out that there's actually more to this town than meets the eye. It's set just after the end of the Civil War in America, so in the late 1860s, just as the sort of real Wild West is getting going, I guess. And it evokes that period, I think, quite well. The art is quite sparse, and it's drawn in a relatively expressionistic way. The characters are very drawn out with very elongated trunks and body parts and so forth. By trunks, I meant the main part of their body. They're not elephants. There aren't any elephants in this story. Whether that's something that's going to be integrated later on into the book, I don't know. At this point, it's not clear. But, you know, I believe the creator's on Twitter. So I guess if you want to know, I'm prepared to wait for the story to play out. But if you want to know, you can definitely contact him yourself. So it actually gets quite a lot done in one story in terms of, like, the first issue providing, you know, a nice, entertaining, satisfying meal. He fights some zombies, he arrives in town, makes an unpleasant discovery, and we manage to have a pleasing conclusion that leads to this particular reader wanting to read the next story, which is very good. There's a little bit of back matter, and there's a nice short essay at the back by James Guy Hill about how he came about writing the story and so forth, which is where I found his Twitter. His Twitter address, which is at James Guy Hill. His art is that the colour palette is very muted. As I say, it's very expressionistic in the way that his pen style is. Possibly a little bit, again, this is a word I hate using, but my artistic vocabulary is rubbish. Maybe a little crude, I don't know. Certainly looks like an indie book. But it was very satisfying. It was very well read. At times, there's a little bit of narration. At times, I thought narration was slightly overused. I think it's something of a theme I've been back to more than once in comics. I like to, I guess you should. You should show, not tell. But I think it's an easy hole to fall into, and getting the balance right can be very difficult. But otherwise, The Dead Don't Die is 69p on Comixology. Well worth your time and 69p. Pence or 99 cents if you're listening in the States, I guess. The final one, continuing our theme of the Wild West that I established just then, is it's an image book. It's Sparks Nevada, Marshall on Mars number one. It's from, obviously, Sparks Nevada's from the Thrilling Adventure Hour, the very popular podcast, more popular than ours, so clearly I'm not overly keen on it. Podcast. Yes, and it's written by Ben Acker and Ben Blacker, with illustrations, it says, by Jay Bone. I was thinking about, when I was looking at it, actually, I was thinking about what does the style remind me of, and I kept going through it, I couldn't really think. It kind of reminds me of Archie, if that makes sense. Good. I'm glad it does to you. So, this particular story, Sparks Nevada, Marshall on Mars, he is protecting a stagecoach that's landed on Mars after visiting one of the moons orbiting that planet, and he has to take them across the circumference of the planet to get to where they're going to. He has to protect them from the various banditos, robot banditos, and Martians, potentially, that live on that planet. Although they stop him, so the Martians are kind of like your proxy for, they're essentially they're the Indian Wild West Indians, because the story is it's a Wild West story told in a futuristic style. So it's, I don't know, kind of steampunky, I guess, in that respect. So the Martians intercept Sparks as he's taking these guys back to wherever it is they're going to. I don't know, I can't remember. And they tell him that actually there's some enemies that are after him, and he needs to be particularly careful. And he's very blasé about that, because he is from Earth, as he is fond of saying. And so, as they're attacked, adventures unfold, which is great. It was a highly enjoyable book. Now, I mean, I've listened to Thrilling Adventure Hour once and enjoyed it, but I'm not an avid listener, so it was a while ago, so I'm not overly familiar with Sparks Nevada, and I had previously read an Akron Blacker book which I reviewed on the podcast, Flash Gordon on Dynamite, and one of the things that I complained about there was it was slightly overwritten, felt like it was written for a radio play, so there was lots and lots of dialogue and very expositional dialogue as well, because obviously you've only got the spoken, you can use sound effects obviously, but you need to get the most of your exposition done in dialogue and radio plays. I felt like I was overplayed. That was definitely not so much the case in this at all. There was some very long monologues within it that felt very much like a radio play monologue, but it fit really nicely into the actual story here. It was really enjoyable. The voice, you could hear the voice of a 1930s radio serial coming through, if that makes any sense. Really evocative of what it was based on, in my opinion. And I found that the characters had incredibly strong voices. It's written in this Western patois, which meant I had to go back occasionally and reread it, because I sort of skipped over it. But actually, it gave the characters incredibly strong and incredibly distinctive voices, which was really useful in terms of reading it and added another dimension to my enjoyment. So the really nice, thick-lined, very confident sort of cartoon Archie world, allied with these really strong voices that they've created in the characters, as well as a thoroughly entertaining script, meant that I think it was a really good light-hearted comedy comic book, which is something comic books can be funny, and you know, they're called the funny pages, and you read an awful lot of thrillers and in all sorts of sort of genres, but I can't think off the top of my head of an awful lot of out and out good honest comedy comic books that I read. I think if you are on the lookout for something that's just gonna leave you satisfied, a bit like, you know, I felt after reading this the way I feel after listening to a really good half hour comedy on Radio 4. It's just, you're probably not going to be laughing out loud the whole way through it, but you feel very satisfied by the end of it. It's as a whole a very enjoyable thing, and certainly the creative team on this seemed to be working really nicely in sync. It was a really lovely and well told storybook, and again, I think this one's relatively cheap on Comixology. In fact, all of them, I think actually Holy Fuck was 69p and this was £1.49, if I remember rightly. But this should be in your comic book shops, I would have thought. I know, talking to Nick earlier today, he saw it and didn't pick it up, which surprises me, because I know he's a big fan of the Thrilling Adventure thing that I was talking about earlier. Okay, well, I'm going to go back to whence I came, and there's a rock with a hole that's got my name on it somewhere. Hopefully I'll be back in the studio next week with the guys, and that'd be very nice, but until then, I'll back to them.
This week, the first issue of a comic that I actually did a preview review of a few weeks ago came out. It's called Secret Identities. It's written by Brian Joynes and Jay Ferber, with art by Ilias Kyriakis and Charlie Kirchhoff. It's a comic about a super team, but it's mainly about their secret lives. It's called Secret Identities, so that's kind of a clue. It's about their secret identities, and it's kind of... It's sort of got an almost TV series feel to it, in that, and when I say that, I mean shows like Scandal and stuff, where there are all these interlocking characters and they've all got these secret lives, and into that there's a turbulent agitator that messes with things. It's a gorgeous looking comic. It's written really well. I said when I talked about it before that it's I try to avoid superhero comics. There are loads of superhero comics that aren't the main two universes, DC and Marvel. And to be honest, an awful lot of the possible stories involving new characters have kind of been done. There have been lots of updated real-life versions of superheroes done in the last few years. This one's really good, though. I did a full review of that in episode 12. So if you want to go back and listen to that, you should be able to find it quite easily using the show notes. But I won't talk about it at length here, but it's on the shelves this week and it's well worth it. Really, really good. I saw it in Forbidden Planet yesterday and it looked great. 2080 this week was a really good one, so I will talk about it a little bit. It's Prog 1918.
Say how nice the cover is.
It's a really nice cover, and it's a really unusual one as well. It's interesting, actually. Who is that by?
Sorry, I put you on the spot there.
No, it's fine. Because if you hadn't mentioned it, it's by Rufus Daiglow, which makes sense. Rufus Daiglow, I think, I don't know loads about him, but I've read a few comics by him. And I think he kind of started doing Tank Girl comics for IDW. And his work, although it's very unique and individual, does reflect an awful lot of the artists who were really influential in the early 90s in British comics. So James, it looks kind of, you can see Jamie Hewlett in it, you can see a bit of Philip Bond, and you can definitely see some Brett Ewins. I think that's a coincidence that that happened to be the cover this week. But it's really nice to see it. It's very bold, lots of really clean lines. The covers on 2000 are quite often fully painted. Yeah. They're quite often very heavily rendered, and they all always look great, but this looks really different. Yeah. It pops a lot. It's for a series that has its first episode this week. It's the second run of a story called Survival Geeks, which is written by Gordon Rennie and Emma Beebe, who I think it might be the first time a female writer's actually worked on a prominent story in 2008, wow. To be honest. It's quite weird. I was thinking about it, and I don't think there have been that many. I know that there are female creators working on lettering and stuff like that, but I don't think there have been that many female artists or writers in 2008, if any. So that's quite notable. It's written by Gordon Rennie and Emma Beebe with art by Neil Googe. And I liked the first iteration of this story quite a lot, actually, despite the fact that it's mainly an excuse to do lots of geek references. one of the things about it is there are so many very specific references to stuff that's going on now-ish, like the Doctor Who 50th anniversary and stuff like that, and these very geeky responses to that, and Star Wars and stuff like that, that when so much in 2000 AD ends up being really timeless, that, you know, stuff you can pick up in 20 years' time and it still resonates, this is quite fixed in the present day. But it's really good. It's this story about this girl who, I think she has she's quite geeky, and she has a one-night stand, or she ends up going on a date with this guy, and she's overnight in this house. It's a shared house full of male geeks. And inexplicably, while she's there, the house gets starts tripping through dimensions and times and stuff like that. So she's basically stuck. She has like a one-off date with this guy. Seems to go okay, but not brilliantly, but she ends up staying overnight, and then she's stuck in this house with a bunch of geek archetypes. Much better realized geek archetypes than you get in Big Bang Theory, but still, they are kind of typically geeky guys. It's very fond of geeks, but also takes the piss out of them quite a lot, because she's into the same stuff, she knows all the same stuff, but she's not as high on the spectrum as the guys in this comic. It's probably wrong to say as use high on the spectrum as a metric, but I am what God made me, Jane, and I can't change now. It's really, really cute. They didn't have to get such good. The colour by Gary Caldwell is really good as well. They didn't have to make it as gorgeous to look at. It's really a pretty cartoony style. There are creatures in it, but there's also loads of stuff that's in this geek house with posters and like cool posters and stuff on the walls. The characters didn't have to be as well realized as they are. There's kind of a tragic moment where it starts with the female lead lamenting the fact that she's stuck on this dimension tripping house with these guys, and the most attractive, seemingly most together guy who lived in the house went on holiday immediately before. So the only person that she might have had anything in common with or whatever is on holiday. But the guy who she had the date with sees her lamenting this. And so there's a sad little moment there where there's a not a love triangle so much, but it's kind of a bittersweet moment. It's all played really nicely. There aren't that many stories in 2000 AD that have female leads. And when they do have female leads, they're normally pretty rugged archetypes. Like, they're pretty ferocious. They're strong in that traditional sense of strong, where they're badasses. To have a female character in this who's so contemporary, who's so, like, just a normal person, and she's really good. It's really, really it's a really nice story. I like it a lot. So that's Survival Geeks. The Judge Dredd stories are great, but it seems to be kind of it's in the final act now. I think it's a gorgeously painted, well written story about killing doctor, like killing or being killed by dark judges on a space colony, which is pretty cool. There's this really weird, I don't know what's going on at 2000. There seems to be a, I don't know if it's a mandate or if it's just a coincidence that this has happened, but there's a new Thargs 3 thriller starting this week as well called Station to Station that starts on a train, starts on an underground train. It's written by Eddie Robson with art by Darren Douglas and letters by Ellie DeVille. And our focal character is, I guess she's a Muslim immigrant. The narration is from her viewpoint, and she's not sure if she's going to be allowed to stay in the country. She's not allowed to work, so she's having to beg, basically, on the tubes.
Aww.
Her pride's obviously hit by this. She doesn't like the fact that she's having to do it, and she's very aware that people don't like the fact that she's doing it. And then very quickly, it turns into this really weird, surreal sort of metaphysical horror story involving a whole bunch of other people. It's a weird, it's really odd because it takes in race and racism, and it's got, again, a female character who's not the sort of character we see in comics very often. Kamala Khan in Ms. Marvel excluded, you know, she's it's another story that's set in the present day. And so this isn't racism and cultural stuff seen through the lens of space aliens or anything like that. This is actually on a tube station in the present day. And it's quite interesting that these two stories happened at the same, like started at the same time in 2000, because it's not the sort of story they normally do.
No.
And it's really, really good. That's gorgeously painted as well. And Savage is continuing in the back. That's really good. But I've talked about that a lot before, so I don't need to talk about that again. 2000 this week is a really good jumping on point. Really, really nice. It's £2.45.
It's worth it.
Yeah. It hasn't always been recently, but this week it really is. I'll talk very briefly about Silk, number one. It's $3.99 from Marvel. Silk is a... She's got spider powers. She is a character who was in a bunker in the Marvel Universe for ages and ages and just got, like, found by Peter Parker. She's very tied into all of the Spider-Man stuff. He and she kind of give off these weird pheromones. So whenever they're around each other for too long, they end up like all over each other. So this is clearly her branching off on her own. I got started reading it. It's written by Robbie Thompson with art by Stacey Lee and gorgeous color art as well by Ian Herring. It looks gorgeous. It's got this really, I want to say manga influence, but it's really more like Becky Cloonan / Brian Lee O'Malley influence. Really
wow.
Bold lines, really dynamic movement, and it's gorgeous looking. The color palette's quite nice. It all moves in sync, and the writing's good, but there's quite a lot of info dump. There's very clearly this situation where the writer's very aware that they're trying to introduce this character that people might not know, and also establish their own voice for this comic. But I got started reading it, realized that I was going to enjoy it, and then realized that it's following immediately on from the end of Spider-Verse, which I'm really enjoying, but I'm about 2 or 3 weeks behind on. So if you're up to date on Spider-Verse, it's definitely worth reading this. I kind of knew Silk was going to survive because she's quickly become a fan favorite, and she's one of the few spiders in it that were set in our universe, and it was unlikely that many of those were going to die. But the Spider-Verse story has been killing off versions of Spider-Man and Spider-Woman and et cetera, left, right, and center through the whole of its run. So I stopped reading so that I didn't learn too much about how that finishes, because it's a really good, I've really enjoyed Spider-Verse. I don't want to spoil it for myself. The other comic I bought this week is issue one of 8. It's written EI8HT, or it might be Infinity. It's hard to say.
Oh, let's have a look.
I think it's 8. I don't think it's Infinity.
Yeah, no, that's...
So it's, It's written like 7, but it actually quite works. It does look like a G. I mm-hmm. hadn't considered that it would. A really gorgeous, striking cover by Raphael Albuquerque.
Hot dog.
Yeah, and I thought this might interest you. I'm just going to open this. I thought this might interest you, actually, because he's an artist who you've got much more experience with.
Oh, I do, yes. He's American Vampire, isn't he? Yes, that's right, yeah.
I've always liked his art, but I don't read American Vampire, so it's a very striking cover. Dark Horse have been doing a lot of really good comics recently, and it's weird because the model for what Dark Horse do, for what Dark Horse have always done, has been... They kind of set the blueprint for what a lot of other companies did. They did a lot of licensing. They got their money earners out, like their Aliens comics and stuff like that. And then they started doing lots of really inventive, I think, creator-owned stuff off the back of that.
Wow.
So it's interesting to see a comic that looks so much like an Image comic.
Yeah.
It's but I don't think it's derivative of... It looks quite a lot like the cover looks quite a lot like Low or something like that, the Rick Remender books that are coming out from Image at the moment. But I don't think it's derivative. I think it's just that people have looked at the Image covers and thought, well, that goes against perceived wisdom about what a comic cover needs to be.
Yeah.
And it seems to be doing okay, so maybe we can actually start using our creativity a bit with covers.
Yeah.
It's a really striking cover, and the composition of it's just amazing. It looks really good. Because I don't know if the listener might not know this or might not have realized this, and I'm sure Jane does, though, but the traditional wisdom with comic covers is that you have to have the logo.
Yeah.
It's based on when comics used to be in news racks in America, in newsagents, which they haven't been for years. So the logo has to go at the top, and it has to be very bold, and so does all of the corporate logo. And then later on, when they were on comic shelves, certain elements have to be on the left-hand side, because that's where, like, when comics are folded over each other, that's where they are. And that's been the model for how comic covers have been designed forever. But obviously it's just not relevant anymore, because comic specialty shops don't present their comics like that, and digital comics don't look like that anyway.
No.
So anyway, gorgeous cover by Raphael Albuquerque. I just want to check. The story is by Raphael Albuquerque and Mike Johnson. The script is by Mike Johnson, and the art and colors are by Raphael Albuquerque. This story is kind of weird and kind of amazing in how it's told. You can tell that it's very much Raphael Albuquerque's thing, even though he's written it with someone else, because there are loads of tricks and techniques in the art that are amazing that I'll get onto in a second. But the story opens with in a kind of a barren landscape with a man breaking out of a craft that he doesn't remember how he got there. He doesn't know what's going on. He soon remembers that his name's Joshua, and it turns out that he's got short-term amnesia, so he's left little, like he's got a number 8 written on his arm because he's been put in this craft and sent somewhere by this scientist guy who we're introduced to, who's kind of one of the other main characters through the story. We see him in flashback or flash-forward.
Oh, okay.
And he's told at that point that he might have memory loss going on the journey that he's going. It quickly becomes apparent that he thinks he's being that the plan is that he's going in a time machine. He's being sent on a mission,
yeah,
to the past to do something, and that he'll have memory loss. And the 8 is significant because it allows him. It gives him information that allows him to communicate with the people who sent him back from the future. Sorry, I'm feeling a bit bilious, Jane. I'm sorry. And the story kind of plays out in fragments like this. As he remembers stuff, we see that stuff happening. But the color is really significant because on the first page, well, not on the first page, on the first facing page, you get like a color key. It looks like a design element.
Oh,
it's really clever.
That is clever.
It says the past is green, the present is purple, the future is blue, the meld is something else entirely. And that's green, purple, blue, and this kind of orange color.
Mm.
And then the first facing page And the colours in this book are... Rafael Albuquerque's art is really bold anyway. His composition is amazing and very simple, and really he makes the important bits pop by having quite simple, bold compositions. And when you throw in a really bold colour palette into that, then this... what sounds like it might be quite fidgety, this four different time periods or four different realities, each having its own color code, sounds like it would be really complicated. But the really bold color scheme with that information kind of works, because the first thing you see is a really sort of orangey-yellow page, which is the meld, which we know is something else. And immediately you're thrown into this comic or this sort of uncertain world where you don't really know where he is.
Yeah.
Something's clearly gone wrong. And then when you start getting into the flashbacks, which are flash forwards because he's been sent back from the future or whatever, it's a time travel dimensional comic. It's all going to come clear in the end, I'm sure. But you instantly know what's going on with flashbacks, because flash forwards, flashbacks for him, flash forwards for us, because they're in blue. And I think the other stuff, the other colors, are going to become more significant as the comic goes. But it's kind of science fantasy. It's not hard science, but it's sort of science fantasy fiction. Really strong, bold concepts. The story of a man out of time. He quickly discovers that there are like weird dinosaurs in this world. There's a civilization in this world. So there are all of those elements that come from John Carter and Flash Gordon and all of those things as well. And there are lots of comics that are about a person who finds themselves, a male protagonist who's confused and finds himself stuck in a place, not sure if he's going to be able to complete his mission and stuff like that. But this is so gorgeous. And the writing is really good because it works really well with this very spare art and very spare storytelling. It's a lovely looking comic, and I think it's fair that because of the design on the cover, a lot of people who've been picking up a lot of Image books are going to probably pick this one up, hopefully, or at least it's going to catch their eye, because it's the sort of comic that Dark Horse have always been really good at doing, but the Image have got really, really good at doing recently. And so if someone picks this up thinking it's from a different publisher, they're not going to be disappointed by what's inside it at all. It's really, really good. I liked it a lot.
That's good. No, I'll definitely be picking it up. That looks incredible. And it's Rafael Albuquerque, and I do love his art.
Yeah, and I mean, I've liked his art before, but it's so bold in this. It's got a very European sort of feel to it. It looks like his work, but also quite different, which is sort of good. I like it. So that's all the new comics. Okay, let's listen to Max Barnard. It's the first proper part of his The History of Manga, which he introed a couple of weeks ago. So here you go.
Okay, we have issues. What follows is the actual first part of my history of manga. Last part was a bit of an introduction. This time I'm actually going to do a little bit of real art history. I might be missing some very crucial facts. Like, my research for this isn't perfect, but I've put a lot of work into it, and it covers a lot of the core bases of the history of this medium. So hopefully you'll gain a little bit out of it. Failing that, you'll get to hear me pretend I know stuff, which is nice. So let's get to it. So, a lot of people like to believe that manga began in its earliest form with the legendary Chōjūjin Busu Giga, which I've definitely said wrong, the animal person caricatures, a series of four scrolls depicting the antics of a selection of anthropomorphized animals as they go about their lives, full of odd little moments and a frankly startling amount of Buddhist imagery. It doesn't really look anything like what you'd call comics, though, more just single images with a running theme. The only real connection it truly has between it and modern manga being that it's designed to be read from right to left, and that it's drawings. It's also pretty heavily disputed as to whether it's really the first manga. A lot of people claim that Shigisan Engi, a painted scroll about a monk who did miracles, which probably didn't involve magnets and how they work, so... It's not really a relevant joke. I don't think people even make Insane Clown Posse Miracles jokes anymore. But yes, a lot of people like to say that that was the first example of manga. And a lot of other people like to say that neither of these have anything to do with modern manga, rather just being unrelated works of art in their own rights, which is nice. I suppose a point of comparison would be the Bayo Tapestry. It tells a sequential story, but we don't call the bugger a comic because it's really hard to read on a train. Where should we turn then for the real beginnings of comics in Japan? Well, to ukiyo-e, probably, which I'm also going to say wrong the whole time. Ukiyo-e was this form of woodblock prints and paintings that really picked up somewhere in the 17th to 19th centuries, when the chonin class was becoming wealthy in the light of urbanization and such stuff. All these merchants and craftsmen were getting more money, and that fed into various forms of hedonism and the growing existence of kabuki theater and geisha girls. And where there is pleasure, there is art to be made of it, as these wealthy upstarts commissioned art made of various beauties or scenes in their minds, made at a size suitable for their small accommodations, while still undeniably being finely crafted art. Ukiyo-e was all about very flat scenes and characters, with fine lines and careful use of colours, and a savvy use of closure, giving light details to characters and heavy attention paid to the non-human elements to go and make you connect more with the characters. The sort of thing that people still fail to use to this day in comics work. Not that it's 100% necessary for comics work, but it's pretty important! A lot of these works came in sets, telling specific stories to the viewer, which, whilst not quite the same as manga, is at least a huge step towards it. And failing that, there's always that largest telltale sign of a comics medium existing, the prevalence of erotic art existing in the formats. In this case, we're talking about shunga, which basically means picture of spring. Spring being... Look, it's like a dick joke, right? But yeah, shunga is really interesting as erotic stuff goes, simply because it's just matter of fact. Most ukiyo-e artists just happened to do shunga art too, and it wasn't really taboo by default because nudity was so gosh darn prevalent in society. Public baths were still a proper thing, so you'd see the naked bodies of everyone around you with fair regularity. So how big a step was it to then draw that as a scene? Or to progress that to people boning, clothes optional. You'd get all these sets telling erotic stories or one-off images of fair notoriety depicting stuff a bit more risque, like same-sex relations, which were a bit... Well, look, I won't presume to know the exact scenario at the time, but they've always been treated a bit odd in Japan. Or, that one image of an octopus eating someone out by Kasushika Hokusai. Remember that name, by the way. Hokusai is super important to manga and will actually be the focus of the very next part of this series. Artistically, the most interesting thing about shunga is the genitals. Like, they treat a vagina as this oversized expressionist thing, a true face for women who were supposed to all maintain this identikit painted face of beauty at the time. It's kind of treated like the fanny is where the true feelings and expressions are held, this great maw of lust that can't be anywhere else. Dicks are basically just dicks, though. Which I guess is, like, patriarchy? I don't know. You can still see ukiyo-e in comics nowadays, it being this huge influence on Japanese art, and is in fact the entire style used for one of my favourite comics, the currently running gag manga, The Tale of Isobe Isobe, with the subtitle Ukiyo-e is Difficult, which uses the art to define the era it's set in, as well as to stand out amongst everything else on stands today. So yeah, I named a modern comic while talking about art history. That's how you know I haven't got a qualification. Finally, you'll notice I hesitate to call shunga porn, and there's something to that. There's this weird thing where it almost feels like calling good erotic art porn is to underplay its worth and more so its importance in art history. But then, I mean, look at some of the excellent comics out now, like Chester 5000 or Smut Peddler, which are unashamedly porn and great through and through. Maybe it's a personal hang-up, but it's worth noting just to get across how much shunga really is proper, real art. Just like porn can be. Oh god, I've trapped myself in a hole here. Join me next time to talk about Hokusai and his work, because I don't know what else I can say without tripping over my own contradictions. Bye!
Ow. I just hit myself on the side of the head.
I thought you made a noise with your mouth.
No, that wasn't a performance bit. That was me hitting myself in the side of the head with my hand. Which was really stupid. Jane!
Yes! I have a spotlight. Mm-hmm. As we said at the beginning of the show, I'll be talking about Black Hole by Charles Burns. I am a person who goes through phases, and I identify this about myself. So if I like a particular actor, I'll go through a phase of watching everything they're in. If I decide that medical dramas are the coolest thing ever, I'll watch every medical drama. That's just my thing. Part of being a fangirl, I'm pretty sure this is the foundation of it, the yeah. intensity of liking something, followed by the fickle dismissal of it after I'm bored of it.
Done that for 6 months yeah. of 24 hours. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just right. done. And I do it with my, not spotlights, but with my non-weekly monthly comics. So when it comes to sort of actual hardback books and things, I will go through phases. And Charles Burns is one of the phases I'm going through at the moment.
Yeah, because you just read the...
I did, The Hive, and I can't remember the other one, which is really bad.
I think in our first episode you talked about one of those. Yes. First episode of We Have Issues, you talked about one of those.
Yeah, I spoke about both of them, and the third one is due out very soon. It might even be out now, actually, I haven't checked. But Black Hole was one I got for Christmas, and this is a book that he did before those, before this trilogy he's doing at the moment. For the listener, Black Hole is a book set in mid-70s suburban Seattle. It's an odd... It's completely surrounding teenagers, so it's all about a couple of groups of teenagers, and there is a disease, a sexually transmitted disease, which mutates people. So it could be that you grow a tail, or it could be that you just get a few lumps, or it could be that you morph into something completely different. It's a really peculiar disease. And this particular book is, well, on that basis, the story follows it's about three or four different key characters as they go through the normal teenage troubles of fancying people and sex and all this, you know, growing up, and they want to be treated like adults and things like this. They all end up, this isn't a spoiler at all, mm-hmm. but they do in fact all end up contracting this sexually transmitted disease, which doesn't really have a name. They call it the bug, or I think they reference it as something else quite Teen Plague, which is even
Teen
worse.
Plague, that's a rubbish name.
I don't know, it sounds like a really bad magazine. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's very full on. So they've got, the book brings out the contrasting effects of hormones. So there are people that are acting out of characters, people do when they're in their teens, and they, you know, they either quite shy and then become a bit more boisterous and outgoing. Or, you know, they seemingly tend to settle down when they're always a bit sort of jack the lad and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a hormone aspect of it. And then there is this part where they've all, under certain circumstances, from having sex, they've contracted this disease. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. I mean, that's the main subject.
Yeah.
But it all happens very horribly. It's bad enough that they end up with this disease. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, each one has quite a sad tale of how they got to that situation. So yeah. I'll pick one.
Is it told in chapters? Sorry.
It is told in chapters. So you do focus on each main protagonist mm-hmm. throughout the book in those chapters. The first chapter focuses on one of the girls, and I can't... Sorry, no, the second chapter focuses on one of the girls, and I can't for life remember her name, which is awful.
Do you know, I always forget to even look. And I did go through a phase of actually noting down the names of main characters, because it just doesn't seem to that important to me when I'm talking about stories.
No, I did actually make a list, but it's in another notebook that I haven't brought with me, because for reasons, listener, I've ended up carrying this book around for about three weeks, and it is quite a hefty book as well. Chris Rhodes, that's the first girl. So we meet one character, I think his name's Kevin, and he quite likes this Chris Rose. She's quite a quiet girl, very academic, popular, you know, that kind of thing. And He is quite obsessed with her. Each character does have a very strange foresight kind of dream sequence as well. So their fates are teased already. They already know what's going to happen to them. But Chris acts odd. She kind of wants to lose her virginity.
Yeah.
And she kind of doesn't really care so much about who it's going to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a party and there's a boy that she fancies and she loses it to him. What she notices after they finish is that he has something on his neck, at the base of his neck. And what he actually has is another mouth.
Oh.
Yes. A mouth that talks. So there's two mouths. This mouth talks to his subconscious. And that's when you discover that he has...
The teen plague.
The teen plague. And now she has it. Obviously, we don't see symptoms and, yet. Anyway. So she now discovers that she has it. And she sort of... Not that she's given up on life or anything that extreme, but she's very carefree in doing things out of character, going skinny dipping and things. But when she does, there is evidence that she has got teen plague, which her friends see, and things go downhill from there, really, for her. I mean, Chris, out of all the protagonists, she's sort of the main character because... she's a reoccurring theme. So you've got the boy, Kevin, who fancies her, and then the boy, I can't remember his name, who she had sex with and got the disease from. And because they have very physical attributes to the disease, they sort of run away from home and they can't really integrate with society, and they find other groups of teens that have got extreme, disfiguration from it and can't be around other people. And obviously it's like the, it is like the mark of the plague. Mm-hmm. They have got it. Some of them don't have such obvious symptoms, but even still, the way that they lose their virginity is just not very nice. Everything is very sad.
Sounds quite bleak.
That's the perfect way of saying it. The book is very bleak. Nothing good happens really to anybody in this book. And to top it all off, the main mystery throughout the book is people who have got the plague, the teen plague, are being murdered. So there's that aspect as well. So it is extremely and it is something I've come to learn about Charles Burns, is that he is quite bleak.
Yeah, it's very nihilistic, isn't
it? It's extremely surreal as well. It leaves you feeling really kind of like, oh, this is all really horrible. This is all a bit, there's just nothing good. No one could ever say something to these kids that's going to make them feel better. It's all pretty much done for them, really. And it was the same with the other books that he's done, which are a surreal fantasy of something that's quite serious has happened to the main character in that, which we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with this. It is all really surreal because this disease is so alien. It is literally, people look alien. They don't even look like anything you could think of in the normal medical realms. That they're just, growing tails and all sorts of things and, extra mouths, and that just, we know that wouldn't medically happen.
Yeah, so it's just weird. Yeah, it's just very odd.
Yeah, and it is a sense of body horror as well. It's just like, obviously, the things you can liken this to in the real venereal disease world is things like HIV and hepatitis and things that are incurable. You can't see them though, and they have horrific symptoms, but you don't necessarily have, you look at someone, you wouldn't say they have HIV. So it's kind of that you've got this incurable disease that could potentially kill you, because it, depending on what disfigurement is, it could be quite dangerous. But not only that, it's also people know. People look at you, they'll know. So there's that horrible element to it as well.
It's weird. I mean, so it's not about that. It's kind of not about the disease. You don't find out anything about it except that it exists.
That was the only thing. I mean, that was the thing I went into the book. I thought it would focus more on disease. But
like
it
an epidemic story.
Yeah.
But it isn't.
No, the disease is just, it's just there. It's just, it's come about out of nowhere, really. Kids are getting it. Just seems to be teenagers, not really adults. there are people who have had it for a while, there are people just getting it, and there's people who are around people that have it. So it focuses a lot more on how the disease treats the people that have got it and what happens to them and how their lives sort of pan out. So it's you know, you've already got this horrible situation of being a teenager and going through all that crap, when added to the fact that you've finally done the thing where you just wanted to get out of the way of losing your virginity, and now you've got a sexually transmitted disease from it that everyone now can see that you have. And also kind of for some of them it will lessen the pool of who they can interact with and who they can have relationships with. So it's really hard going. I really enjoyed it, though. That's the horrible part about it.
Do you feel, is it reflecting anything? I mean, aside from HIV and actual diseases, do you think it's kind of bleak because it's reflecting stuff about teenagers and like actual life? Because it sounds like it's quite... You were talking about how because they're adolescent, they're already behaving in quite hormonal ways anyway. So all of those themes, the isolation and isolation and people being able to see that you had sex and
that
virginity and stuff like that, it all seems to be quite tangled up with being a teen in a particular view of what it's like being a teen.
Yeah.
It seems quite reflective of that. So,
And it is sort of, you know, of the times around the 70s, you had free love and there's all of that side of things, which people didn't really know the effects of or the dangers of free love until the 80s. And then it got completely used to terrify everybody with as well. Mm. But it is sort of, it's still a taboo at this stage. So you've done a shameful in this time, you've done a shameful thing and people can see you've done it. So it reflects like the turbulence of being a teenager, and I think it also reflects it has a real element of depression in it as well. There's sort of no getting away from that. It's not melancholic, it is depressing. It's just people realising that their life is now not anything they ever wanted it to be. And with these murders as well, that's having an impact on certain characters, and that's pretty bad too.
doesn't sound like a very traditional narrative either. It's not like follow that main character. You see her getting infected, but it's not a pure A to B to C narrative at all.
Absolutely not. And it is about how it affects people in different ways. And there are, like you said, there are chapters as well. So there are a lot of sub-characters that actually have a lot of page time too. Mm. So they're really important to the story. And their sort of tale that they have to tell is really important and crucial. And you still, again, you don't get any... how the disease came about, you know, if you don't fixate on that at all, you don't need to, and it doesn't get resolved. It's just there, and these people have to live with it, and it's how they're going to live with it. The narrative is, like you said, quite unique. It flows really well, though. You don't ever get confused. You don't ever misunderstand what's going on. You've got a surreal disease full of, and then you've got very surreal dream sequences and visions and things. So there's something a little bit supernatural about it all as well. Again, same with surrealism. It's enough for it to be a believable thing and still be very alien.
Yeah.
As you couldn't comprehend it, but actually it is, that could happen. So it's got that balance between the two really nicely. And the art as well. The art in itself is very weird. He has a very weird style. The art style in this is completely different to what he's done on The Hive and the other books as well. And it is very, it feels 70s and it feels very odd and gritty and things like that. So it's been reflected really well. And it is extremely detailed book. Mm-hmm. Extremely detailed book.
It's huge. It is huge. I didn't think it was.
Yeah, but this is the fourth time I've lugged it around with me as well. And I finally can go back on my bookshelf. I highly recommend it. I got it as a Christmas present, so I do not know how much it is. But on the inside jacket, it does state it's $17.99. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure the person who got it for me got it for less than that. But
I'll put links to it on Amazon on the site.
Yeah,
obviously, you might want to buy it from an independent bookseller who's local to you or somewhere that isn't Amazon. But Amazon is quite often quite cheap, and they are affiliate links. I should, full disclosure, if you follow any links to Amazon from the pod, from the podcast episode site thing, we get a little bit of money.
it was published in 2005, and it's a Jonathan Cape book.
I think a lot of his stuff comes out from Fantagraphics, maybe. But
yeah, it says here, this work was originally published as 12 separate comic books by Fantagraphics Books Seattle from 1995 to 2004. Mm-hmm. So a great collection of those books. Oh gosh, I can't even imagine reading those monthly.
It sounds like hard work. So what you're saying is it's horrible and sometimes depressing, and you liked it,
but it's so beautifully articulated that, I mean, like, I've read The Road and they've watched film. It is horrible. It is absolutely horrific, but it's the way it's delivered. You know, horrible things do happen in life and they shouldn't be ignored in the literacy world. And you shouldn't ignore it by default because it is a horrible subject. And that's what this book does.
I totally agree. I think it sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Creepy.
It's
a creepy cover. There is something very old fashioned about his art style. Yeah. I like it, but it's weird.
It's weird, and it fitted it so well.
It's certainly not boring, which is what that idiot in the... Never mind. Never mind.
Yeah.
thank you, Jane.
That's okay.
That was lovely. Worth the wait.
Thank you.
Although probably not worth carrying around for... I mean, I don't know. It sounds like a right hassle.
It's not so bad. I think I'm more annoyed that I forgot my notebook that I wrote people's, because there are lots of characters in this, and I wanted to write... I had written a few notes, and I forgot it. I was like, damn it! I didn't get time to try and go for it again today. I've remembered it pretty well, I think, though.
I think Kieran Gillen shared something in the week about how much various comics weighed, and you carrying that around made me wonder how much it weighs. But we can't possibly know.
I don't know, maybe a pound? It weighs about the same amount as a guinea pig, I suppose. About a pound?
Is that your metric?
I think excellent. I read some of the guinea pig weighed a pound. I was like, oh, I need that. So, yeah, it's about that. Yeah. Maybe it needs to go on a diet. I don't know.
That's ridiculous. Thank you, though. That's awesome. Okay. Peter Hammerson's been doing event management for, well, he hasn't done one for a few weeks. I'm not trying to guilt you, Peter, but I really like them, so you need to do them more often. But here's his third one. It's about the Kree-Skrull War. Not Skull. Skrull. Skrull War.
Hello. My name's Peter Hammerson. And this is Event Management. Space, the final frontier. Well, unless you count the negative zone, the multiverse, the antimatter universe, the bleed, the source, pocket Earth, counter Earth, limbo, the other limbo, the other limbo, hypertime, hell, the dream dimension, the place the mindless ones come from, but I digress. Because as far as the Marvel Universe of 1971 was concerned, space was still largely unexplored. Today's event is a landmark in the opening up of the Marvel Universe, and a contender for being the story that made Marvel Cosmic a thing. It's epic, it's weird, it's essential reading, it is the Kree-Skrull War. The Kree-Skrull War is a storyline that was originally published in Avengers Volume 1, issues 89 to 97, during late 1970 to early 1971. The arc was written by Roy Thomas, with art by Sal Buscema, Neil Adams, John Buscema, Sam Granger, George Roussos, Tom Palmer and Alan Weiss. Sam Rosen, Artie Simek and Mike Stevens provided the letters. In some respects, this is an odd choice for an event. I've been defining an event using the three C's: crossover, continuity, and consequences. The Kree-Skrull War is not a crossover. All the action takes place within the pages of the Avengers, and only has a couple of cameos from the rest of the Marvel Universe. The guest stars who do feature, which is the original Kree Captain Marvel and the Inhumans, didn't, to my knowledge, have their own books at the time. But when you consider the stakes that are raised in the story, the Earth is almost destroyed twice, and the long-lasting effect it's had on the continuity of Marvel Comics, the Kree-Skrull War is absolutely an event. Development set in motion in these 9 issues still reverberate today, 44 years later. And the character moments and subplots, particularly with regards to the Vision and the Scarlet Witch, came to be defining parts of their characters. So, what is the Kree-Skrull War about? Essentially, it's the story of how Earth gets caught between two enormous galactic empires. That of the shape-changing Skrulls, best known as opponents of the Fantastic Four, and the Kree, whose most famous representative is Captain Mar-Vell, who had his own Marvel series for a few years prior to this storyline, and liked to pit himself against Thanos, he of the Infinity Gems. The story spans the length and breadth of Earth, from New York, where an anti-alien senator stirs up public opinion against the Avengers, to the Arctic, where the Kree try to devolve mankind back down the evolutionary ladder. Ant-Man travels into the body of the Vision in an awesome Neil Adams illustrated chapter. The Inhumans guest star, and we follow them from San Francisco to Atalan. And finally, the Avengers find themselves in space, defending Earth from a vast Skrull armada, while Rick Jones has to learn to harness the power of humankind's ultimate destiny, or see everything he's ever known get swept away. Basically, the Kree-Skrull War has a lot going on. It touches on how foreign wars affect the innocent territories they sweep across, and draws up a little parallel between anti-alien hysteria in the comics and the anti-communist hysteria in real life. The most important thing about the story, though, is how Roy Thomas finds a way to explain how a relatively primitive planet like Earth always gets mixed up in these cosmic shenanigans. Not only are we positioned in a strategically useful spot in space, but it's widely recognised that humankind's ability to advance technologically, as well as produce so many mutants and superhumans, will see us become a significant force in the universe. And as such, this gives writers a simple explanation as to why any cosmic entity or alien army are interested in us. I really like the Kree-Skrull War, and I'd recommend it to anyone with an interest in the history of the Marvel Universe, Marvel Cosmic, or the Avengers. Some warnings, though. This is a late Silver Age Marvel comic, and it's written like one. It's heavy on the exposition, which I like, but I know isn't to everyone's taste. Also, the Wasp is handled very badly. She gets very little to do except get upset, and then gets written out of the story altogether because she caught a cold. But if colourful dialogue is your thing, then the Kree-Skrull War is an excellent set of Avengers issues and well worth your time. I have the story as part of Essential Avengers Volume 4, but it has been collected as its own trade, and I believe it's also up on Comixology and probably Marvel Unlimited as well. Now, that's it from event management this week, but I'll be back soon with another awesome comic book event. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so I think that's us.
Yes.
Do you have any plans for the week? Is anything exciting happening?
I can play more Minecraft. I am being very weird and erratic with my game playing habits for some strange reason. I've been staying up quite late to play Minecraft and being very tired at work the next day.
That's apparently a disease with Minecraft.
Yeah, I know. And it was inspired by Nerd Cubed. I am quite a big fan of Nerd Cubed. He is a... are they called vloggers? No, he does Let's Plays.
He's a YouTube guy. Yeah.
YouTube guy. He does real life things, but he does a lot of Let's Play and games and stuff like that. And he's you know, very funny guy. And he started off... He started off with Minecraft comics. Screenshots of Minecraft of things he'd created, and then did a comic, which I thought was really cool. And then he started on the Let's Play videos, and I started watching these Minecraft ones. I was like, oh my god, you could do so much more in Minecraft than I knew about. So I started playing it again, and I've turned off the baddies because they scare me so much. The creepers are horrible. Have you played Minecraft?
I've played it a little bit, but I've played a lot of Terraria, but I imagine in 3D those guys come out of nowhere.
Oh my god, it's horrible. And they just like blow up next to you. So I've turned that off for now, but I'm terrified of lava and I keep falling in it. So that's just really, I keep jumping as well. So I don't know, it's some sort of self-torture thing.
Are you playing it a lot in the middle of the night though?
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, that's probably not helping.
Probably.
I just played through. I've noticed you online, actually, while I've been on Xbox, because you're playing on Xbox.
Yeah, right? That's right.
Because you get, there's like two free games that come with Xbox Live every month.
Yeah.
And mostly I don't end up playing them because there's just too many of them now and I've got a backlog. But I ended up playing through the whole of Battlefield Bad Company 2.
Oh, okay.
Just, it's exactly what I want from first-person shooter, in that you can shoot through things and, like, buildings explode and stuff like that, which doesn't happen enough in your Call of Duties and stuff
like that. I'm not a fan of the Call of Duty or the Battlefield games. It's just not my thing. I don't know why. I've got lots of friends that play them online as well. And
I think part of the reason it might not be your thing is that playing 3D games where things can just jump out at you clearly is something...
Oh, no, but I'm usually okay with it. I mean, I did have to develop an Australian accent whilst I played Dead Island, because that kept scaring the crap out of me, zombies just popping out of everywhere.
Why Australian accent?
Because it's my character was Australian.
Oh, I see.
So okay. I was being an extension of her, so I could get a bit more submerged.
A bit more ballsy.
Well, yeah, so I could, like, the machete in my hand was real, and I could really kill the zombie, and it wasn't really going to hurt me. And the same with... you're right. I am quite jumpy through games. I'm just thinking about... Bioshock. Bloody hell. Yeah, Bioshock Infinite. That game. There was the... I can't remember what the character's called, but... if you play Bioshock Infinite,
yeah.
The character that's like got a submarine, an old fashioned submarine helmet, and then it's I think they're called the light men because they've got the light coming out there.
All right,
They've got almost like permanent ear trumpets, and light comes out of them. And there's one scene in that game where you turn around and there's one right there, and my God,
there's a lot of jump scares in those
games. I don't
scream,
but I screamed and I dropped the controller across the room as well. It terrified me so much. So I don't like jump scares at all. I seem to pick games that have them in.
That doesn't happen as much in the war-oriented ones, but I tend to find them more boring. But yeah, I enjoyed Battlefield. It's quite short as well, though.
Oh, that's good.
The Bad Company 2 is quite short, and you're this group of quite wisecracking. It's quite irreverent, because a lot of those games are fairly relentless. And there's a point at which you're faced with, there's no jokes, there's no action movie veneer to them. You're literally just killing dudes over and over and over again.
I've seen some stuff where I've just sort of... The morality of it, we're like, oh, that's not... I mean, I know in GTA 5 there has been some controversy about the old torture scenes in it and stuff. And that was pretty bad. But from what I've heard, these games do have worse scenarios.
Largely because of life partner Steve, actually, I think, because he's the guy who's talked the most about Saints Row. Him and Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon on their video game podcast, The Indoor Kids, it's called, have talked a lot about the Saints Row games. Mm. And I need to get back to it, but they were on a bundle on Steam recently.
Oh, yes, no, that was, that was a good deal.
So I tried playing the second one, and I think it's just too old and ropey on the PC. But I started playing one of them, and I started playing GTA 5, and technically it's fun, but for me... there's something too nihilistic, and because it's so crisp and everything's designed to look so real, and they're doing so much more with cinematics, and the cinematics look like real characters. Yeah, that sort of moral blankness of them gets to be too much with a real thing. Whereas the Saints Row games are so fun, so cartoony.
Really, really tongue-in-cheek.
And I've got my character, I think because when I was creating my character, I had maybe been reading a lot about gender and ethnic representation in things, and so was feeling a bit weird about, well, I wanted to play a female character, but I didn't want to play like a leggy supermodel style female character because I've been reading too much of that. So I picked a slightly bigger character model. And she's awesome. She's like this black character who's got, like, I picked a nice voice for her. And the Saints Row games are so good at just making that work.
Yeah.
Like, whereas the GTA games are very masculine, and you can change the clothes they're in, but you're still on a track and you don't feel like you've really got any ownership of the character the way you do in Saints Row.
No, it is completely... Yeah, Saints Row is very tongue-in-cheek. You've got Professor Genki and stuff, and you can make your own characters, and you can make them like you or like anybody. And you're right, they do have set phrases, and they it all fits in very nicely. Mm. It's nothing out of the ordinary. I remember just going off a little bit on a tangent, having a slight argument with somebody about GTA 5 about the misrepresentation of women in the game. And I was like, that's true. It is, you know, none of the women are particularly strong female protagonists. But the men aren't particularly likable either.
Yeah,
I think it's just all of them are very heinous, and they thought I was like an anti-feminist, and I was like, no, I'm equalist, and again, everyone in this game are equally horrible.
If you're looking for positive character or any sort of decent representation, the GTA games are just a bit too hard. They've found their groove, and their groove is pretty nasty.
Yes, no, it is the worst of humanity displayed in that game.
I just started playing XCOM again on my PC because I bought that in a Steam sales are a nightmare.
I know, that's I can't. And do you know what the nice thing about having a MacBook Pro? I'm like, oh, it's not compatible.
So you can't buy
it. I know, but the relief. And then, because part of me in the back of my head's going, well, you could make it compatible for £2.97, of course. But so I just can't do it.
It's like
too many games I bought for it.
Steam sales, Humble Bundle stuff, it's all, oh, but it's so cheap. How can it mount up? Because that's how money works, you idiot. Yeah. And you're never going to read all of your Humble Bundle comics. And you're never going to play all of those Android games that you bought on it. You just like the idea because, oh, never mind. That's a whole other dysfunction, isn't it? It's really bad for certain sorts of personality, and I have one of them. I think that's us, isn't it, Jane?
Yes.
Thank you to all of our contributors. Thank you to James. Even though he wasn't here, he still got on the show. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you to all of the people who retweeted. Even though we kind of bribed you into sharing us with comics, and we're doing it again this week, we do really appreciate it. And thank you, listener, even if you haven't shared us or RT'd us, if it's your first time or your last time. No, that, don't say that. That's depressing. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. We're going to go now.
Bye.